fascinating. My own modest answer to the last question is behavioral research. I mean, before...
we have to predict behavior before it happens. Or okay. Try to.
Well, I mean, you know, this is not my debate, but... But since you asked, I mean, if this were 20 years ago, or a generation ago, we would assess public opinion in Arab countries or any countries by what people actually do. Are they protesting against the United States? Are they burning American flags? Are they, you know, boycotting American goods? Whatever they're doing, and we don't do that anymore. All we do—it's almost exclusively now a focus on what people say is their view. May or may not have any relationship to reality. It may not have any policy or behavioral implications. We have subtly but profoundly changed the basis of our assessments in favor of professed attitudes rather than actual behaviors. And so, anyway, this is a plug for a study that we're undertaking here, a rather large and intricate study to put together the alternative way of approaching this question, which is based on behavior rather than opinion. The commercial is over. Let me. I'm sure that these two presentations have provoked quite a few questions. I will start with John, and then work over here, and Steve, and others. Why don't we take a handful of questions? And if you could try to be brief, and then I'll turn to our questioners after a few.
John? Hi, John Alterman from CSIS. Thank you very much for that fascinating presentation. I want to ask Dave about his policy finding, and it's going to link to Scott, so don't get out of line of fire. I mean, one of the things that I have indeed noticed the same thing you have, that the support for terrorism has diminished considerably. It seems to me that's partly a consequence that the governments have successfully mobilized their information apparatus, their intelligence apparatus, and the clerical establishment that has a sort of ambivalent relationship with them, and help drive public opinion toward the direction that it wants to go. Where this ties to Scott and the Project FICRA work is I think there's also a sense that we have to go beyond governments. We have to look more deeply into society. But what we're seeing in the findings that I hear you talking about is a sign of the consistent and persistent salience of governments in shaping public opinion, and that goes to a question of whether, in fact, we should be spending a lot of time on public opinion, or should we be directing our efforts toward working with governments to help shape their public opinion, as, in fact, they've done very successfully on the terrorism work.
And on the anti-Americanism.
Yep.
In the other direction.
Yep. Thank you. Hold that. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, hold that.
Into the mic, please, if you could. Yeah.
My question's for you, David.
Yeah.
You had a couple of very interesting implications for U.S. policy. I think there's another one that's not so much for the State Department as it is for our elected officials or candidates for high office. And that would be, perhaps we ought to take a cue from the shift in Arab public opinion toward the use of violence in the spurious name of Islam, and stop talking about this kind of violence and terrorism as if it's part of some global threat against the United States or against the West, since it's really aimed at the societies and governments of Muslim countries. The very notion that Al-Qaeda had as its end objective establishing the caliphate in Washington or New York or London is frankly so silly. But if you think about it, that's certainly what they intend to do in governments all the way from Jakarta to Lagos.
Steve Rosen?
In 2001... Pakistanis saw a symbol of American capitalism burned to the ground and the Pentagon on fire. In a few months ago, one of their popular leaders was murdered. If Pakistanis saw tomorrow the stock exchange on Wall Street burning down, Maybe they'd be happy about it. I mean, terrorism, as has so often been said, is a method. And it's like saying, are you in favor of firing a gun? I'd like to know who's at the other end of the bullet. I wonder if the decline in support for terrorism is simply because recent terrorism has not been against targets that are popular targets, but targets that don't have popular support.
Okay, why don't we take these three questions? If you could come up and use the mic.
Okay, government influence on public opinion. I think that governments in these countries have an enormous influence on public opinion. But I think it's also very, very hard to measure. And in the case of the decline in support for terrorism, as best I can figure out, the decline is so swift in the wake of a major terrorist incident in a particular country that that circumstantial evidence is so compelling that that seems to me to be much, much more important than anything that the government say or do. Now, what, in other words, it's the actual occurrence of a terrorist incident. That's what changes public opinion, and that's what also motivates governments to try and stop this sort of thing and to convince people that they shouldn't support it. I think that it's quite possible that government efforts in this direction have had some useful effect in prolonging, once public opinion shifts, in helping to make sure it stays that way, it stays against terrorism. But it's hard to measure, and therefore I don't think polls really can tell us very much about it, if just focusing narrowly on our topic today. I do agree that we should pay attention to what governments, how governments are shaping their own public opinion. And Scott Carpenter's, I think it was, aside about, and also about anti-Americanism, I think Egypt is a wonderful case in point of that. Because even as the Egyptian government has labored to turn its public, or help turn its public, or help keep its public opposed to terrorism, it works day and night through its official, semi-official, controlled and media and every other way that it can to stoke anti-American feeling. And that is something that we should talk to the Egyptian government about. And there's pretty good polling data that suggests that one of the reasons why Egyptians are so much more anti-American than, let's say, Moroccans or Jordanians even, is precisely that the Egyptian government has encouraged them to feel that way. And why has that happened? There's some polling data that suggests that it's precisely because the Egyptian government knows that it's so dependent on the United States in some respects that it needs to do this, or feels it needs to do this, as a kind of balance or something like that. It suddenly struck me one night while I was writing this paper, maybe too late at night, that Egypt, in a way, is following the Qatar example. Host the largest American air base in the Gulf and sponsor Al Jazeera. Well, the Egyptians are kind of doing the same thing in their own way. Be a strong military and other political ally of the United States and make sure that your population gets daily doses of anti-American media coverage in order to kind of pretend that you're hedging your bets, you know, you're squaring that circle somehow. A very important point, but, you know, needs a lot more further discussion. Yeah, please, if you want to add to that, yeah.
Well, I'll just add from here. One thing
Talk right into it.
Okay. Yeah. Are all the countries that have gone down in their support for terrorism, have they all actually had terrorist attacks on their soil? I'm not sure that every single one has. Egypt.
Yeah, in Sinai, sure.
Well,
yeah. I mean, that the timing is very clear to me, at least. After the hotel bombings at Sharm el-Sheikh and Dahab and Nuweiba.
I think that definitely has something to do with it. Absolutely. Yeah. It has a lot to do with it. But I think there are some countries that have gone down without an actual terrorist attack on their very soil. Now, they are also seeing terrorist attacks of neighboring countries.
Right, yeah.
So they're experiencing it through, right. You know, Al Jazeera or whatever.
Right. Or other Muslims, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. I want to get to quickly to David's question and Steve's. I agree with you. I think that calling this Islamic terrorism is bad, and we should stop doing that. And you know, no argument for me on that. I don't know how much difference that would make to anybody, but it might help a little bit, and we need all the help we can get. On Steve Rosen's question, the polling evidence is very clear that when Pakistanis turn against terrorism, what they say is that they also include terrorism against American civilians. And that's true in all of the countries that I've talked about. The questions are very, very clear. You know, American civilians in your country. And so it's quite explicit that it's not just that they're against people killing their fellow Egyptians, Pakistanis, or what have you, but also against killing American civilians. And in the Pakistani case in particular, what was so striking to me about this sudden turn in opinion was that the question actually asked explicitly about should the Pakistani government cooperate with the U.S. in its war on terror. And in many other countries, if you brand it the U.S.-led or the U.S. war on terror, you get lower levels of support than if you just say U.S., than if you just say war on terror without attributing it to the American government. I see absolutely, from polling data and from everything that I know, I see no reason to think that Pakistanis, as collectively, would be happy about that or would think that it was okay. No, absolutely not.
Pakistani investors in Bear Stearns, Michael? a few, we'll go to the next round. Oh, Dolly, did you want to add anything to these questions? Or?
Well, the only thing I would say is we have asked people around the world what they thought of 9/11 specifically. The attacks on, you didn't call it 9/11, we called the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And we've asked them a generic question on attacks on civilians and did find that majorities in Pakistan said that the attacks on the Pentagon and the World Trade Center was morally unjustified.
Okay, a few next round of questions. Ali and Simon. And Mike Kraft, Marvin and Kent. Go ahead, please, briefly. Into the mic, please, Ali. Or right behind you.
Ali Liami from the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Saudi Arabia. David, I think you did an outstanding job in doing the research. It's too bad you didn't consult with me. I could have given you an inside scope in the situation in Saudi Arabia. Okay. Next time.
All right.
Thank you. The 95% of the Saudis who said they approve of King Abdullah, if they were free to express their feelings, 99.9% of the Saudi populations, for different reasons, would tell you that they would like to see the Saudi royal family taken out to the ocean or someplace. The Arabs actually, Saudis, I read Talhame and Zoubi and Espositos and all of these people views and polls about the Saudis and others in the Middle East. One Zoubi's and others in Talhamay's, we just heard it now actually from Mujahid, that there is a tremendous amount of anti-American sentiments in the Arab world. That's nonsense. And let me give you one example. In Saudi Arabia, they have scholarships. And the scholarships for students to go and study abroad are allotted or divided between Asia, Europe and the United States and Australia. Nobody wants to go to Asia. Mm-hmm. They want to come to America.
Yes.
These are the very same people that tells Talhameh and Zoghbi and others, we don't like the American policies. Frankly speaking, if you open the gates for all Arabs and Muslims to come to this country, those countries will be empty of population and they will come here.
Okay, what?
My question is this. My question is this, and it is actually towards Mujahid. You said if the polls are done correctly, you could get good results. Question is, how do you do correct polls in a region, in countries like where you and I come from, where people have no rights, and where the very same government that say they fight terrorism are actually terrorize their people more than the terrorists themselves? And finally, and this is just out of the cuff, I'm told that your study or your group is sponsored by Saudi Prince. Is that correct or no?
No, it's not.
Okay.
It's not correct.
Hold off just 1 minute. We'll take a couple more questions. Thank you, Ali. Simon?
One can tell the difference in height between me and... it's about 45 degrees of microphone. Simon Henderson, the Washington Institute. Always amused by such occasions because they stretch our powers to understand. And one's tempted to make generalization about pollsters, a group that many of us don't have a chance to make generalizations about on an everyday basis. And my temporary conclusion is that they're thin-skinned. As a former journalist, and since journalism or journalists were mentioned in derogatory fashion a couple of times, my reaction to this is we shouldn't be asking so much, or the journalistic way of going through this is not to, the interesting question is not what people actually think, but how they think. It's easy enough to conclude that they are against terrorism. Let's not go into the definition, whatever. But a journalist would find that, yes, people would say they're against journalism, terrorism, but they would equally say, after incident B, A or B of last week or the week before, the response would be, from the average Joe, but we can understand why it happens. So the policy challenge is not to get more people in the Middle East to say what they think, but isn't it to change how they do think? Or although I appreciate the and one response to that is, and they would say perhaps, is for us to change how we behave. But, you know, I'm out there in the Middle East. That's the question I want to put to them. Thank you.
Mike Crock.
Must be something about former journalists, because as one, I've always been intrigued by the intensity factor in polling. And this gets a bit into the behavioral question. Do any of these polls try to gauge the intensity factor? I mean, it's one thing to say you're against terrorism or you're against the U.S., but trying to do it like on a scale of 1 to 10, because, you know, it only takes a small handful of people who feel very intensely to conduct terrorist attacks, etc. Is the effort made throughout the polling, or is it something that tends to be glossed over? And also, David, if you could mention briefly, you said there, in your opening remarks, there's some demographic issues that you found. Sure.
Okay. Antonia?
Thank you. My question is actually goes back to the title of the presentation today, which is bad news or bad data. Okay, so you told us about bad data, and then journalists and headlines in newspapers come once or two into the conversation, but actually, I mean, and you find that there might have been other headlines when you dig into data. So my question is how much, or if you will elaborate a little bit more on how bad news can be also done or elaborate from even good data.
Okay,
so I'm going to try some push polling here with a biased question and then some option loading on it. But my question is pretty simple, which is, because you take a very academic perspective, but isn't a bad poll better than no poll at all? Would be my question. And this is why. If you take an instance like Saudi Arabia, Libya, UAE, or there are other places as well, where there isn't polling, isn't there at least a bad poll builds the culture of public opinion and builds a sense of entitlement on the part of the people that over time might build a culture that would allow free polling? The second piece would be, let's say in the case of Yemen in the presidential elections last year, there was a poll done that its methodology was problematic. But what it did was show that Saleh did not have 99% support, which forced Saleh then to respond to what he perceived to be public opinion. So again, my question would be from, yes, the ivory tower of academia, these polls may not be perfect, but from a political perspective, they can be extraordinarily powerful and actually build the groundwork for doing polling. So again, the question is, a bad poll better than no poll at all?
Okay. All right. Dahlia, if I could just add one last question, because I think this is going to be our last round. You mentioned a moment ago about the polling conclusion that Gallup had from their 9/11 question, or their, that the majority did not find it justified. I seem to recall that Gallup had findings that large percentages, I think majorities, did not believe that Arabs perpetrated 9/11. So if large majorities are totally wrong on their basis of the facts. I mean, if they think that Jews or the Mossad or the Americans or the CIA or whoever perpetrated 9/11, how are we supposed to judge the relevance of a second question about whether it's justified or not justified?
Okay. All right, I'll try to answer as much as I could remember as quickly as I can, or read my notes about it. Anyway, Antonia's question, if I understood it, about bad news and bad data.
Bad
news, that's right. No, as they say, what do they say? They say no, good news is no news, right, or something like that, yeah. And so you're right. The poll, there's nothing that I can do. And my apologies to current and former journalists to convince headline writers, especially maybe not the actual reporters or the editors, but the headline writers. There's nothing I could do to convince them to stop being sensationalist or to stop, you know, highlighting the worst thing that the worst light that you could possibly shed on something. That's just what they do, I guess. And the task, therefore, for us is to read not only the poll data, but the reports about the poll data with a very critical eye and figure out for ourselves what the numbers really show. I would just say this. If I had to give a capsule good news, bad news. My view is basically this. The bad news that Pew and Zogby and the Program for International Policy Attitudes and lots of other pollsters tend to highlight is not really as bad as it seems because of this decline in support for terrorism, right? But the good news that Dahlia and her co-author are highlighting about Muslim attitudes, whether it's on shared values or on 9/11 or some other things, I think the good news isn't really as good as it seems either. And part of the reason for that, in my view, is that although it may be that only 7% of Muslims worldwide said that 9/11 was completely justified, that doesn't mean that the other 93% are moderates. How many of those other 93% said that 9/11 was mostly justified, or even partly justified? Or how many of them said that it wasn't justified at all, but are still anti-American and anti-democracy, or anti, at least, you know, real democracy, religious pluralism and women's rights and all kinds of other things? Why should they be called moderates just because they don't think 9/11 was completely justified? That sounds like good news, but you got to be careful about that too. Okay, Mike Kraft's other question about intensity. Polls try to measure intensity, but they're not very good at it. And they routinely ask, do you feel that way strongly or only somewhat? They use 10-point scales or 5-point scales. They ask follow-up questions. They ask open-ended questions, which I agree with Dahlia are very, very important and valuable in finding out what's on people's minds, not what you put into their minds as a pollster. Right. But measuring intensity is very, very hard. And that's where the behavioral research that Rob talked about, I think, is essential. Polling data are useful, yes, if they're good, right, and if they're interpreted properly, but only up to a point. When you start to ask, well, are people really going to do anything about any of this, the polls will not answer that question. They simply will not, unless you're talking about an election. And that's a whole nother story, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about terrorism, and we're talking about countries where elections are usually not really free and fair, and so on. Okay. Simon's question. I'm not completely sure I really understood it. I'm not sure that Simon is even here to listen to my answer. So, oh, there you are. Sorry. But if you were asking about journalism and what to do about this, like, is that the question?
Rob made the same point in a similar way,
right?
Which is if
more clearly,
well, perhaps in a, but which is that you know, if they have a range of views, if people have a range of views which we think are wacky, why do we believe those part of the views which appear to give a sensible answer?
Okay, all right. Well, look, people have different views about things, and we may think they're wacky, and they may think we're wacky, and they, you know, that doesn't mean that we can ignore their opinions, wacky or not. And on the 9/11 issue, that I'm sure Dahlia wants to say something about that as well, but I would just say, from what I can see, not so much from the Gallup polls, although they seem to agree with this, but from Pew polls and others, it is true that a majority of people in many of the countries that are polled about this, which includes some key Arab countries and other Muslim countries, a majority say that they do not think that 9/11 was perpetrated by Al-Qaeda or by Arabs. And that majority has actually been going up over time, not down. Now, that's what they say, but whether deep down they really believe that, or whether they just kind of have a feeling that they better not come out and say it out loud because that would seem somehow shameful or insulting or politically incorrect or something like that, I don't know. And I think if you look at the responses, you will see that just because it's very important to be careful here. Just because a majority in Egypt or Jordan or Pakistan or Indonesia, those are the, or Morocco, I think. Just because a majority in each of those countries says that they don't think that it was Al-Qaeda or Arabs that did it, doesn't mean that they do think that it was Israel or the American government or the Mossad or the Jews. They don't say that. And I don't think they think that, except for probably about, and I'll tell you what the percentage is, 29% typically say that. Most of the others say, I don't know. And when people say, I don't know, in this part of the world, what they're usually really saying is, I do know. but I don't want to say. Okay?
Sorry, but hold on. You've just said...
I thought I answered your question.
No, not really. Yeah. Because you made out that you gave them an alternative option if uh-huh. they didn't believe it was the Jews or the Mossad who did 9/11.
No, it's
there's
usually...
There's another area called, yeah. I don't know, but right. I'm not prepared to use, say it's Al-Qaeda.
Right, right, well, that's right.
Which it's is not... unsatisfactory, isn't it?
Well, of course it's unsatisfactory, but what are you going to do? Torture them until they...
Well, don't believe in what they say about Lego, I think, is the issue.
Right, okay.
Yes, Donna, you have the last word, I think.
Oh, wow. Well, I had a number of questions asked of me. Well, the first one, I think, was how do we get good responses in places where people don't feel free to... don't have the freedom to speak their mind. And it's, I'm not claiming that we have a perfect answer for that question, but here's what we've done to try to get as close as possible to a response. First, it's the science of how we craft questions. So we try to give people, distance them from the controversial issue by saying, some people say X, others say Y, which comes closer to your point of view. And that's just a way to phrase it where it feels a little safer to give a socially undesirable response. We do all our interviews in home, face-to-face, in private, not in coffee shops, not over the phone, which gives people more comfort in it, to say what they really think. We also ask open-ended questions, which gives people a way to speak their mind. For example, we ask people, what do you resent most about the Muslim world? Now, that's a general question, but it gives people about the Muslim world, it's a general question, but then they have a space to talk about what they are critical of in their own country. So if Egyptians are talking about political and economic corruption, they're probably talking about Egypt. But we have asked it in a more general way. And so that's one way to get at it. We have made attempts to compare our results with other data, not just polling data, but, for example, as I think David explains in his paper, Transparency International. So we've asked people about their perception of corruption in their own country. And we've looked at the correlation between people's perceptions and what Transparency International says. And part of that, of course, it's not purely a hard measure, but it's a bunch of different things that go into the Transparency International Index. But we found that there is a very strong correlation, as high as 0.7%, or I'm sorry, 0.70%, 70% correlation, 0.7, in how people answer both questions. So, the other thing is we do look at things that that might not be politically correct to answer a certain way. So moving toward greater democracy will help Muslims progress. We got 81% of Egyptians saying yes to that. A different poll, I think it was public opinion, global public opinion, the University of Maryland poll, found that 80% of Americans said that democracy would work there. So when you get a similar question having a similar percentage in the same country, you can start to feel more sure of the results you're getting. But there's no perfect way. I still go back to saying, I do think a scientifically rigorous poll is better than guessing. And I think asking people directly, giving them as much comfort as is possible to get them to say what they really think is better than simply relying on people to tell us what their publics think. Okay. Second question was around how people think, not just what they think. And I think we do that best by looking at focus groups and having a more in-depth discussion. And then open-ended questions are the second best thing. Briefly on polls, are bad polls better than no poll? It depends on what we're trying to do. If we're trying to make policy, then no. I think bad polls are worse than nothing because they are misleading. It's just like an instrument that gives you the wrong number. It's better not to measure. But are doing polls good for the population to feel empowered, to feel a sense of entitlement, and to start the culture of democracy? Yes. And then they would be good for that. But that data should just be thrown out, and we shouldn't take it seriously. And then the whole thing about 9/11 and who committed it and how do we understand questions or the responses of saying they condemn it. Essentially, we're not just looking at the 9/11 question. We've looked at other things just on attacks on civilians in general and have found that there's very little support. So a majority condemning 9/11 is repeated or reflected also in other ways of asking about terrorism. Now, we did ask in 2001, who do you think carried out the attacks? And we asked that question before we asked them whether or not they thought it was Al-Qaeda or Arabs. So we first asked, open-ended, who do you think did it? The most frequent response, and this is across the board, and this is a weighted average across these nine countries in 2001, at 16%, or I'm sorry, the most frequent response was don't know, at 20%. And then refused, just people who didn't want to answer the question, was 11%, which made up 31% of the people, a third, that's the plurality, just didn't want to answer or didn't know. Or said they didn't know. So no, don't know and refuse was 31%, 20% was don't know. Then it was the U.S. itself, and that was 16%. 14%, which is right after, was Osama bin Laden. 13% was the Jews or Israel, 13%. 11%, non-Muslim terrorists, didn't specify. And then 3 and 2% of just different random things. So when the majority after that say they don't think, they don't believe the, what I call the official story, or they didn't believe it was Al-Qaeda or whatever, it does not mean, like David said, that the majority believe it was the U.S., an inside job, or Israel. The plurality actually just simply say they don't know. And then the other thing, finally, is we do ask people in select countries to explain their response to 9/11. Why do you say that is what we ask after they respond. And those who condemned it say that it was an attack on civilians, innocent people died, murder is hated by God. Those who condoned it say the U.S. is an imperialist power. This is what they deserve. So it seems very clear from the follow-up question that people are answering the question we think we're asking. Thanks.
Can I just before we break, just one last question based on David's comment. Since you're being very generous with the details on this question, on the question of the percentage of people who justify... In great detail, the book makes a big deal out of the 7% that totally justify. Can you give the breakdown of people that, say, partially justify or partially, et cetera, et cetera?
Right. I can't off the top of my head, but we are going to be putting in some of that research or some of those findings in a preprint, and we'll also put it on the website. So some of that extra data will be out there. To clarify a couple things about the book, is not a hardcover polling report. The book is a book about the modern Muslim world that uses polling to inform its analysis. So that's important to understand. It's meant for a general audience and it's not meant to be a polling report. One very important reason why is because Gallup is selling subscriptions to its data. We are a for-profit company. We're not Pew. We are Gallup. So we didn't, this isn't about, it was not meant to be, here's all the data for free that cost us $20 million to collect that we paid for all on our own. So just to clarify that. How did we come up with our definition of politically radicalized, which is the word that we use, unfortunately, in our book? And here's why. Because the fives, the people who said that 9/11 was completely justified, look distinctly different from the fours. At first, before we had enough data to do sort of a cluster analysis, we lumped the fours and fives together. That was our best judgment.
But and what percent was that?
I seriously don't remember, but I think it was in the range of 7 to 8% was were the fours.
Okay,
overall.
So 7.5 yep. and 7.4.
Yep, yep. And we lumped those together and we did the analysis that way. When we had enough data to really see where things broke away, here's what we found. The fives looked very different from the fours, and the ones and the all the way through the fours looked similar. I'll give you one example. We asked the question, sacrificing one's life for a cause one believes in. How justified is that? The percentages of people who said it was completely justified among the ones who said it was that 9/11 was unjustified. So I'm just going to read across. The ones, 21% of them said that sacrificing one's life was completely justified. 12 among the twos, 14 among the threes, 15 among the fours, 48 among the fives. A big jump. So it looks like this. It's a basically a little straight line almost, and then a big leap when you get to five. And we saw that consistently. And so the fives just simply looked very different. They broke, they clustered away, and the ones through fours clustered together. And that's how we decided to break them apart and decided how we were to define politically radicalized for our research. Now, terming a four moderate, yes, we can certainly agree that, you know, probably they're not very moderate if they're saying four to that question. It was, I mean, I don't know, you're writing a book, you're trying to use terminology people understand. You know, it wasn't maybe the most technically perfect word, I will admit. But that's how we, you know, we broke the two groups apart. It was really data driven based on this cluster analysis.
Okay, thank you for that explanation. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David, congratulations.
Thank you very much.